All right, welcome to the show. It's the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we got a packed show today, so we're going to jump right into things as soon as I let you know what it's going to be. Okay, towards the back, or at the back end of the show, we are going to be talking with the notorious Mr. Fish, sometimes known as Dwayne Booth, cartoonist and freelance writer. And we're going to be talking about an exhibit he's curated down at Annenberg School of Communication at USC called Drawing Conclusions, the Editorial Cartoon. All right, so stay tuned for that one. Before that, we'll be talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and one of the co-founders of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network and the movement, the organization against Stop and Frisk in New York City. And we'll be talking about the conclusion of the recent trial of Carl and three other freedom fighters against New York City's Stop and Frisk policy. All right, so you don't want to miss that, a very important case. And opening the show up, I'm very pleased to welcome back to the show Andy Worthington. Andy's a freelance investigative journalist, the author of The Guantanamo Files, and the co-director with Polly Nash of the documentary film Outside the Law, Stories from Guantanamo. And he's also known worldwide as an authority on the Guantanamo torture chamber. Andy, welcome to the show.
Hello. It's great to be talking again.
Yeah, you too, man. Well, we could just sit down and talk and let the audience listen for a while. At least you're not in Sherwood Forest with a cell phone running low on the battery this time, okay?
No, that's right. Yeah, I recall that.
Yeah. Anyway, I wanted to talk to you about, and this is getting very serious, because, you know, one of the things that's happening, I think, in the world today and in this country in particular, but I think it's probably mirrored around the world, is this sudden, you know, there's a sudden sort of like, ho-hum, you know, everything's done. We don't have to, you know, there's, you know, whatever, you know, there's nothing much you can do about anything. And the major issues of the day are still out there. These running sores, these mortal wounds on to humanity are still out there full force, one of them being Guantanamo. And there isn't the kind of response that we need that would be commensurate to the horror of these things, sure. And especially with Guantanamo. So you've taken a stand against that, and a very important stand. Why don't you let people know what you're doing? You just opened up a new website. Tell them about that and why you did that.
Well, you know, with Tom Wilner, who's a lawyer who represented the Guantanamo prisoners in their Supreme Court cases, Tom and I had been talking about it for a while. So in January this year, actually, so for the 10th anniversary of the opening of Guantanamo, we set up a website and a campaign called Close Guantanamo, with the intention to keep the spotlight on President Obama's failed promise to close the prison, and to provide some kind of focal point for people who care, so that we can keep up the pressure. And, you know, now that the election is out of the way, and I must say what a huge amount of money and what an immense amount of time it takes up, you know, to the exclusion of everything. It eclipses everything. It's out of the way. I've now started to notice that a few people are saying, okay, so Obama's back in. What about Guantanamo? Well, we're back to square one, really. It's nearly 4 years since he made that notorious promise to close Guantanamo within a year and then didn't do it. So, you know, the main thing that we've been pushing this year on the website and with the campaign, which has the support of a lot of lawyers and former military figures and some representatives of former administrations. What we've really been pushing to achieve is to raise the awareness of the fact that over half of the men still in Guantanamo have been cleared for release by a task force that President Obama established of officials and lawyers from the relevant government departments and the intelligence agencies who reviewed all the prisoners' cases in 2009. And over half of the 166 men held, that's 86 of them in total, the government doesn't want to hold. The government wants to release these people, but they're still there. So it's really to explain why that is and to try and get some movement to say, if we're holding people indefinitely, and this is indefinite detention at Guantanamo, it's still a horrible and unique situation. If we're holding people indefinitely, that's bad enough. If we're holding people indefinitely and we've said that we want to release them, what does that say about our notions of justice and fairness and due process and accountability? And the answer to all of that is that it's not a very encouraging message. So that's what we're pushing for.
Let's talk about what is happening in Guantanamo now. You mentioned the people that are there. It's 166 people, you said?
Yeah, that's right.
Yes. Who are they? And why are they still there?
Well, you know, over half of these people are Yemenis. And so the biggest problem is that, let's take the cleared prisoners, first of all, and then we can talk about the ones who haven't been approved for release and the ones that are supposed to be put on trial. The cleared prisoners, 86 of these men, now two-thirds of them are Yemenis. And ever since a man from Nigeria tried to blow up a bomb in his underwear on Christmas Day in 2009 and was apprehended, and it transpired that he had been recruited in Yemen, then since that point, you know, in response to the hysteria that arose at the time, which was very manipulated, I believe, very manipulative and very cynical, the president, President Obama, issued a moratorium on releasing any cleared Yemenis, and that stands to this day. Only one Yemeni has been released as a result. So, you know, what the president has said to the American people and to the rest of the world is, we have these processes at Guantanamo to decide that we had the wrong people or that we don't need these people anymore, that we want to release them. But if they're from Yemen, that doesn't count. What trumps all of that, if they're from Yemen, is that we're deciding that everybody from Yemen is suspicious. Everybody from Yemen is tainted by their nationality. The taint is really a kind of guilt by nationality. So we can't let them go. Now, that's an absolute disgrace, but it still stands.
Amazing. You know, well, tell me this. A lot of these people, actually with the Yemenis, this is actually a new definition of indefinite detention, right? That Obama's come up with.
Well, I mean, he has in the sense that, you know, that he approved these people for release and then didn't release them. You know, the other, I mean, it's not just him who did this, but the task force that reviewed the cases, 30 of the Yemenis, so roughly half of them that are cleared, they actually put them in a category called conditional detention. They made this up. They said they can only be released if the security situation in Yemen improves, but they didn't indicate how they drew up this notion or what it would take. Then after we had the underwear bomber, then essentially all the Yemenis were put in this category of prisoner that was created. So, yeah, that's invented. But the other problem that there's been, you know, this isn't just President Obama's failure, is Congress. And lawmakers have imposed onerous restrictions on the release of prisoners to other countries. And Yemen, of course, is one, but it's not the only one. So there are prisoners in Guantanamo from other countries who ought to be released, but Congress insisted that the president had to get the Secretary of Defense to absolutely guarantee that there would be no way that a released prisoner would be able to engage in any kind of anti-American activity, which is an impossible promise to make. And Congress also insisted that anyone who came from a country where there was an alleged claim of recidivism, an alleged claim that this person had returned to the battlefield, as they call it, that it was not possible to release a prisoner to that country. So, you know, Congress has played a huge role in putting the brakes on releasing anybody. And that's the situation we've been in. I mean, President Obama has managed to release dozens of prisoners, but most of that was in the first, was in 2009 and into 2010. In the last 2 years, only a very small number of prisoners have been released from Guantanamo. It's effectively pretty much ground to a halt.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Andy Worthington, freelance investigative journalist, author of The Guantanamo Files, and one of the world's authorities on Guantanamo. Now, Andy, you know, one of the things that's interesting, because this thing, this concept of guilt by nationality is definitely in play in this whole, in connection with this whole Guantanamo scene right now. And that's what I was thinking about. You've written about that a little bit in your, you know, on the website and in other writings about the guilt by nationality and what that means. I mean, it sets up a sort of a given that if you are Yemeni or you are another nationality, you are guilty, and there's really not that much that can be done about it. I mean, it's horrifying. There's one person in particular that you've spoken about a lot, and I probably will not be able to pronounce his name correctly, Shaker?
Yeah, Shaker Ama, mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and his story is just so outrageous in terms of what's happened with him. I mean, here's somebody who is, you know, should have been released a very long time ago. And people are just finding out exactly, one, what's going on with him, and two, what the conditions are that he's been living in, which concentrates a lot about what's going on in Guantanamo today. Can you talk about that some? But before you do, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Andy Worthington, who's one of the world's foremost authorities on Guantanamo, and who is also the co-founder of the new CloseGuantanamo.org website. A website dedicated to making sure that Guantanamo, that torture chamber, gets closed down. All right, Andy, back to you.
Yeah, well, Shaka Armour is a, you know, is a British resident. He has a British wife and four British children waiting for his return. And he, you know, he has been repeatedly cleared for release from Guantanamo as well, like all the other men that we were talking about. This only became public knowledge in September when the government allowed a list of 55 cleared prisoners, their names, to be released as part of a court process. So, you know, we now have the names of people that the government wants to release. It was previously kept confidential. It was supposed to be part of the delicate negotiations about rehousing them or releasing them, which is understandable, I think. But the names are now out in the open, and all the stories that we've known about Shaka Armour being cleared are now actually in print from the United States government, from the Department of Justice. Okay, well, we know that Congress raises questions about releasing people from Guantanamo pretty much to any country that's in the Middle East, for example, or to Afghanistan. We know that they have issues, that there are hurdles that will be put in place. This man can be returned to the United Kingdom, to America's greatest and strongest ally in the war on terror. Where is the problem with this man being put on a plane as we speak and being sent home? And we don't know the answer to that question. You know, Shaka Armour is a very eloquent and very principled man who has fought for the rights of the prisoners persistently. He spent a huge amount of his nearly 11 years in Guantanamo in solitary confinement because of this. And yet he's cleared for release and he's still there. Now, you know, I'm still waiting for an explanation. I'm hopeful that he will be released because I do think that President Obama will have to release some of these prisoners, that the pressure that's on him is not sufficient for it to be a big thing. But, you know, there are significant channels behind the scenes of people saying this is a terrible situation for the United States to be in, that you haven't been able to clear up this terrible legacy that was left to you by the Bush administration. So, you know, I'm just waiting to have that report. You know, Shaka Armour flies back to the UK. I can only think that one of the delaying things, as his lawyers have discussed over the years, is that because he, you know, has been involved in all of these representations on behalf of the prisoners, and because he's so clever and so eloquent, he knows a lot of what took place.
Well, let me ask you this, Andy, because I'd like, that's along the lines of the question I was actually getting ready to ask you, which is, you know, one of the things that Shaka has done is he actually made a statement which really drew my attention. He said, look, I want people to know that the treatment of prisoners in Guantanamo is completely arbitrary, and there are no laws, rules, or standard operating procedures in Guantanamo in Cuba. And he talked about being subjected to violence every day, and he continues to demand freedom and justice. So in other words, he's not somebody who's going to just quietly go off into a corner, you know, in either in Guantanamo or in relation to getting released. I'm sure he wouldn't stand back and say, oh, well, I'm out now, so to hell with it, hell with everybody else that's still stuck in there. He seems to be doing a lot around, we need to stand up and understand what is really happening there and to oppose it.
Yeah, well, I think that it's a very good point that you made in picking up on that comment that Shaka Armour made, because what he's there portraying there, and I think it's very accurate, is that he doesn't literally mean there aren't rules. I mean, there are documents that are supposed to describe how people are treated in Guantanamo. But essentially, this was established as a prison outside the law. And although it's been tinkered with, that's still effectively what it is. So within itself, it probably has some horrible internal logic, which involves, you know, this repetitive punishment of people like Shaka Armour, who won't stay quiet, who insists on his rights. Now, how much that's actually being closely monitored, I don't know, to be honest, because it's a little setup that has its own life. And it's not comparable to any other imprisonment situation. It's the thing that people tend to forget about Guantanamo is that these people were initially rounded up and imprisoned by the Bush administration with the intention of them being prisoners who had no rights whatsoever, no rights as human beings, no rights as prisoners. They fought to get rights over the years, all of which pretty much have ended up being stopped by various branches of the U.S. government, unfortunately. They are still essentially prisoners who have no rights, a different category of human being to anyone else. who's deprived of their liberty. They haven't had trials and been convicted of a crime and been put in a federal prison. They are not prisoners of war held subject to the Geneva Conventions until the end of hostilities. The end of hostilities has not been defined, and they're not prisoners of war. So they are still these enemy combatants without rights, and that's, you know, what Shaka Armour was pointing out in that comment that he made, and it is something that should alarm us all still, because people held, in, like the prisoners in Guantanamo, are the only people held by the United States where they haven't, you know, they haven't been given a sentence. Now, they may have, you know, prisoners may have had terrible miscarriages of justice involving trials, but they've had a judge say to them, your sentence is going to last for X amount of time. The people in Guantanamo haven't been told that. They don't know. Every morning, people are waking up in Guantanamo not knowing whether they will ever be released. Nobody told them anything. To this day, there are still people in Guantanamo who don't really know what it is that they're supposed to have done. That's outrageous. And, you know, in September, one of the men who was cleared for release but hadn't been released because he was a Yemeni died in Guantanamo, a man called Adnan Latif, who the authorities had first said in 2004 that they didn't want to carry on holding him. 8 years later, he died in Guantanamo. What wore this man out? We don't yet know what the cause of his death is, but it seems to me that the place itself, the regime there, wore him out. It literally killed this man. That's disgraceful. And, you know, I understand that it's unpalatable for the American people to have to look at Guantanamo and to acknowledge that this is something that the Bush administration started and that the Obama administration hasn't been able to finish. But it needs to be closed. It remains a horrible stain on America's self-image.
You know, I got to tell you, Andy, when I'm listening to you talk, I also was reminded of Shaka Armour's comment about how he's being held in isolation and has been held in isolation for quite some time, and how this itself in itself is torture, as we know from you know, anywhere where prisoners are held in solitary confinement isolation. And in this case, he was actually revealing that recently that more and more people, and I think you had one of the exclusive articles on this, he was revealing that people were more and more increasingly being sent into these isolation units, that he was seeing people being brought from the general population and more into the isolation units, which indicates for anybody who's out there thinking, well, you know, look, ho-hum, Guantanamo's Guantanamo, come on, it's all the way down. And I do think it's not a question. It's I think the biggest thing that's out there right now in terms of, you know, people who should know better, not doing anything. This whole idea of as Bob Avakian once put it, of these liberals having a very strange version of the Oedipal complex, that they, not so much that they're sleeping with their mother, but that they willfully blind themselves. And that's something that is just that in itself is criminal in the face of something like Guantanamo.
Well, absolutely. I mean, yeah, I agree with you.
Well, to give us a point here now about as we're moving to wrap it up, what are the plans? What do you got going for the next immediate period of time, a few months?
Well, you know, we're obviously, everybody who's concerned about Guantanamo is gearing up, sadly, for the 11th anniversary of the prison's opening on January the 11th in 2013, just a week before the next inauguration. So, you know, we'll be hoping to make a lot of noise for that one. I mean, it's really, you know, it's trying to push on these issues as much as possible that you know, that half of these people have been cleared for release and are still held. But, you know, behind that, and just as fundamental, and the reason that you understand that Guantanamo is so significant, and that I hope people do get this, is that it is the place where indefinite, arbitrary detention has been put into place. It was put there by the Bush administration, and President Obama hasn't stopped it. It's the reason that the National Defense Authorization Act, with its terrible provisions for the mandatory military custody of terrorist suspects, which may include American citizens, was able to happen in the first place. It's the template for tyranny. Until you get rid of a system that says that you can hold people arbitrarily, we are all in terrible danger. We are in danger morally and ethically and legally and spiritually. We cannot pretend that we are a nation that abides by laws while this kind of exception is allowed to exist. That's the problem. That's why people should wake up and act on it. So we need to get the cleared prisoners released, and then we need to chip away at the rest of the people who are held there, because there are dozens of men who have been designated for indefinite detention. So, you know, probably imprisoned for the rest of their lives on the basis of evidence that the government can't take to a courtroom and try them with. The government doesn't believe that it has enough evidence to put them on trial. So what exactly is it holding these people for? That means that this is a weird non-objectively analyzable set of documents that they are relying on, which consist obviously of statements made by other prisoners. I think that it's very clear that this involves statements made by people who were tortured or otherwise coerced, because that's the kind of whole house of cards on which Guantanamo is built, is that the information that supposedly demonstrates that these people are dangerous, so much of it is completely unreliable.
All right, on that note, Andy, we're going to have to wrap up. We're running way over our time right now, but can you just give us a closing thought on this?
I very much hope that, you know, that we will see some progress and that we're not in the same position when we're talking in a year or whatever it is, Mike, because, you know, this has got to come to an end.
All right. Couldn't agree more. Close Guantanamo now. And for people who want to check out what Andy is doing with his website, with Andy and Tom Wilner and all these others who have joined with them, go to closeguantanamo.org. All right. Andy, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Okay. All right. Take care. Talk to you again soon. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Andy Worthington, investigative journalist, author of The Guantanamo Files, and we've been talking, and one of the authorities in the world on Guantanamo. We've been talking about the drive to close Guantanamo now. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party about the recent stop and frisk trial in New York City. So stay tuned. What have I done? All right, in most of America, what people do when they're running with the police on their back. For a vast majority of people, what they've done has been born with a skin color of black or brown. And in New York City, that means 1,900 people a day are stopped and frisked by the police simply for the fact of their skin color. This is not acceptable. It's outrageous, and it's got to be stopped. And joining us today to talk about all this is Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and one of the co-founders of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and with Cornel West, one of the founders of the movement to stop and frisk. And Carl has been on trial in Queens, New York City, with three other freedom fighters who demonstrated against the stop and frisk, and were arrested and faced some charges that meant a couple of years in jail if they were convicted. Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael. And fortunately, I'm not doing it from a payphone in prison.
Well, let's tell people what happened, because we've had you on and we've had Jamel Mims on talking about this case earlier. So let's tell people, give them the good news, brother.
Yeah, the good news is that this year's effort of crafting a case with serious charges for people who stood up and protested the illegitimate, racist, and illegal policy of the NYPD stop and frisk ended in a defeat for the authorities who are doubling down on stop and frisk. Their heaviest charges, obstruction of governmental administration, which they had two counts of on us. They had us facing two counts of, which carry a year in prison each. We were found not guilty on that. We were convicted of a violation, disorderly conduct, but the sentence for that is a maximum of 15 days, and the prosecution indicated that they were not going to ask for jail time after their case had been thoroughly rejected by the jury, which was exactly what should have happened, Because not only is it that stop and frisk is what's criminal, not the people that protest it, but in this case, the prosecution failed to put on any evidence that any governmental administration had been obstructed. So their case needed to have been, you know, dealt a big defeat.
Well, let's talk about the case itself that they presented, because this whole thing, if you anybody takes a minute to look at what was actually presented during the trial, that trial was like something out of Kafka.
Yeah, that's a good way to describe it, because at the beginning of it, the prosecutor who was leading the prosecution listened to the opening arguments from the defense attorneys, and one of them pointed out that the prosecution had the burden of proving beyond a reasonable doubt that some function of the police precinct had been disrupted in order to prove obstruction of governmental administration. And the prosecutor said, "Your Honor, I was unaware that we had the burden to prove anything had been obstructed." I mean, literally, he was saying, because we were going to declare that they had obstructed governmental administration, that was enough to convict us. And then he proceeded to put on a defense that was unable to go beyond that, because the only concrete activity he could argue that we had in some way disrupted was, he argued, these four protesters, he kept saying, these four protesters had made the roll call late at the precinct that afternoon. But then evidence came out that the roll call at the precinct, according to the timeline he was using, was almost always late. So it was kind of hard for him to say that our activity made it late, when every roll call that there was any information on had happened later than the time he said roll call had to happen. So there was no evidence put on, but still they felt that their declaration that we had obstructed governmental administration was enough to convict us and have us facing time in jail. And what it came down to was that they were aiming for a message of anybody who stands up and says no to the repressive things that the law enforcement in this system is doing to people need to be made to pay a heavy price in order to deliver a message to other people: don't do this. Don't try to get in the way. Don't try to resist the things that we're doing to you or to other people.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop, Stop, and Frisk movement. And we're talking with Carl about his recent trial on charges stemming from his fighting Stop and Frisk in New York City. Now, Carl, tell me this, because I read in Revolution newspaper that there was actually an element of a setup involved in this whole thing with the bust and everything else that went on. Can you talk about that a little?
Yes, and see, this plan to deliver this message was crafted from the beginning, because when we marched up to the police precinct, the police had barricaded completely the area in front of the precinct and were allowing no one to come in. So we get up to the barricades and we stop to hold a discussion. Okay, what are we going to do now? They've got us barricaded out. Are we going to go somewhere else? How are we going to approach this? And as we're having this discussion, the police open the barricades and say to us, if we want to protest in front of the police station, we can come in. We march in, we go to the front of the police station, escorted by seven cops who array themselves on the steps, and we start protesting, chanting, "We won't stop till we stop, stop, and frisk," facing the police precinct. And then within 2 minutes, the head of the precinct, accompanied by a member of the police department's legal affairs bureau, begin making an announcement. And the day the announcement was made, back last November, I couldn't hear what it said, but listening to it on video, I realized they at that point had already decided they were going to use the heavier charges, because his warning wasn't just disperse or you'll be arrested. His warning was disperse or you will be arrested for obstruction of governmental administration. In other words, they had decided to invite us in, let us get in front of the precinct, and then once we got in front of the precinct, to immediately tell us that they were going to hit us with governmental administration charges, violating governmental administration or obstructing governmental administration. They gave that warning twice and arrested us very quickly. In the space of 7 minutes, it was 7 minutes from the time we walked through the barricades to when they began to arrest us. So they had planned this from the beginning and aimed from the beginning to hit us with those heavier charges.
You know, it's very heavy. I mean, all of these things that came out in relation to this trial, there's you know, it's interesting because it does sort of shine a spotlight or a focus on what was at stake here. Now, we'll get into this in a minute, but I want listeners to get a sense of how unique this trial is. When I talk about the Kafka element in this, I mean, it goes even further because there's something that I don't think anybody's ever heard of happening before. All the stuff that was going on with the jury. Can you talk about that?
Yes, because we only need with the jury. One of the jurors was arrested while the trial was going on in the court building, and she was arrested over trying to regain the personal property that they had, you know, because there's certain things they say you can't bring these in. Buttons, I had a whistle. They confiscated my whistle. I had to turn that in and get it back when I left. Well, she had had a small Swiss Army knife, which she turned in going in. And then when she went to get it back out one day after court, the people at the property department showed her an empty bag and said, sign your property slip, saying that you have received your property back. She said, well, I'm not going to sign it till you give me the property. Show me my property and I'll sign it. They said, no, you have to sign it first. An argument ensued, and then one of the court officers said, cuff her. And they put her in handcuffs, threw her into a tiny locked room, held her for about an hour, and then wrote her six what they're called desk appearance tickets for disorderly conduct for refusing to sign the property slip without getting her property back. Then she was thrown off the jury for having gotten arrested. Another juror was dismissed from the jury because she was horrified to hear that her fellow juror had been arrested. And my attorney was an attorney with like 40 years of experience in doing cases like this, and he said he had never seen or heard of a case where a juror got arrested in the court where they were in the court building where they were serving as a juror. This was the first time he had ever seen or heard of something like this happening. And then the prosecution began to use this to try to get a mistrial because they could already sense that the trial wasn't going very well for him and they wanted to get a do-over. But we had two alternates, so the alternates were input into the jury, and we were able to take the case through.
Now, let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, a co-founder of the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and one of the founders of the Stop and Frisk movement in New York City. And he just was acquitted, along with three other freedom fighters, in one of the first cases against people who have been demonstrating against this Stop and Frisk policy. Now, Carl, tell me this. You know, it's you talked about, and Jamel has talked about, you were going to go in and put Stop and Frisk on trial. Did you do that, and how?
Well, the way that we went at it, because we knew that it would be uphill, because the judge and the prosecution from the beginning kept saying, this case is not about Stop and Frisk. It has nothing to do with that. It is just about, did these people violate the law? And they followed through with objecting every time anyone tried to say anything about Stop and Frisk. At a certain point, our attorneys were able to point out that you can't object to the term Stop and Frisk because part of what you're charging these people with is the intent to obstruct governmental administration, and to defend themselves and for us to defend them against that intent, that element of the crime, we have to bring out what they were there for. So they backed off and would let you say the word Stop and Frisk, but the moment you begin to talk about it, they would try to object to stop you from doing it, to not allow it to happen. But even with all those objections, it came through clear in the courtroom and in interviews, discussions, and rallies that we had around the trial that, in fact, what was at the heart of this was stop and frisk, that nobody went there with the intention of obstructing governmental administration or acting in some way to cause public inconvenience, alarm, or annoyance. We went there with a message about the illegitimacy of stop and frisk, and over the prosecutor's objections that came out in the courtroom. And like I said, it came out in interviews and other things that we did around the trial. And you add that to the juror getting arrested, it brought to some people who don't experience the arbitrary exercise of police power, it brought it right to them. It became a part of their direct and indirect experience in a real way through this trial. And this is an important part of what we're doing, because we view these legal battles as not a distraction from fighting stop and frisk, but a continuation and a carrying through of that fight that we engaged in when we started this campaign of civil disobedience back last year.
And there actually, when you talk about continuing this fight, actually there's a, you still have quite a few trials coming up, don't you?
Yes, we do, because the four of us who beat the heaviest charges have nine co-defendants who will face trial in Queens, New York, facing the same charges. We had wanted to move for the dropping of the charges, but we were told it was not legally possible to do that within a court case. But we're going to continue to fight to get the charges dropped against our co-defendants. We have nine people who still face trial in Queens. 13 of us faced trial in Brooklyn. And in addition, Noche Diaz, who's a part of both of those trials, faces trials in the Bronx and in Manhattan, where he was arrested several times while observing the police brutalizing people and charged with disorderly conduct and obstruction of governmental administration, and in one case charged with resisting arrest. So we have all of those trials, plus this was about stopping stop and frisk. And at all our demonstrations, we chanted, "We won't stop till we stop stop and frisk." And so that's also a part of our goal in this. We're not just trying to keep the activist out of jail. We're trying to stop this illegitimate, racist policy of the NYPD as a part of fighting mass incarceration. You know, and as a revolutionary, I feel this is an important responsibility that I have, because when you talk about this United States of America, one of the key pillars of this society and the wealth and power of the handful of capitalist rulers has been centuries of exploitation and oppression of black people. And today that concentrates itself in the way that large numbers of black people and Latino people are warehoused in prison, subjected to racial profiling, and treated as second-class citizens even after they've served their sentences. And you don't have the possibility of bringing forward a movement for revolution that can do what's needed, and that would be ending the rule of this capitalist system without involving many, many blacks and Latino people who have every reason to want to be a part of it. So we have to fight and beat back the way that mass incarceration sits as a weight on so many of the oppressed people in this country. So all of that is part of the fight that I'm involved in, and this is a front for taking on injustice, but also bringing to people a message that we don't have to put up with the repression and the horrors that this system brings down on us, that we can stand up, we can fight back, and that when you do that, many other people will stand with you in this fight against injustice.
All right, Carl, on that note, we're going to have to wrap it up, but can you tell people where they can find out more information about the whole fight against stop and frisk?
Yeah, I want to give you two websites. One is www.revcom.us. It's Revolution newspaper website, and even more than that, you get a lot of coverage of the fight around stop and frisk. The other website is www.stopmassincarceration.org. That's stopmassincarceration, one word, .org.
All right, Carl, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael, for having me on.
Okay, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and one of the founders of the movement against stop and frisk in New York City, and one of the freedom fighters who was acquitted on some fairly serious charges in Queens, New York, and is continuing to build this whole fight. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with the notorious Mr. Fish about a new exhibit he has going on at the Annenberg School of Communication at USC. So stay tuned. That's right, it's all over now, Baby Blue, and that is Bad Religion covering Bob Dylan's song. You can find that on Chimes of Freedom. Great cover, great song, great cover. Really enjoyed it, and I thought that maybe, perhaps, Mr. Fish might like it too. Mr. Fish, a.k.a. Dwayne Booth, is joining us today to talk about this exhibit he has going on down at USC at the Annenberg School of Communication, Drawing Conclusions, the Editorial Cartoon. And it is really a remarkable thing. Mr. Fish, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. You know, I was thinking about this thing that was just on the radio about a little earlier, about connecting in profound and mysterious ways. And I have to tell you, man, there's somebody else out here using your name. But he's got it a little bit different. I thought maybe I could get like a meal out of it, but I went down to Senor Fish. And I tried to use my connection with you. I talked about profound and mysterious connections, and they basically ushered me out quietly. So there you go, man. Can't even get a fish dinner by saying I know you, okay?
That's right.
All right. Let's talk about this this exhibit. I actually was profoundly moved by it. You know, I walked in, and I wasn't quite sure what to expect. But when I walked in and I went through this, it was remarkable. It held my attention for over an hour, which is a remarkable feat in its own right. So,
yeah, I mean, there's a lot of reading in it, which is surprising to a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm just glad I brought my reading glasses, man.
Right, but you say, you know, you were surprised by it. I was surprised. I think Annenberg was surprised by it, too, because I don't know if they got what they were necessarily expecting. Because the initial idea was to answer the question, is political cartooning a dying art form? Because the assumption is because since print media is dying, then therefore the cartoonist's job of commenting on politics is also dying. And of course it's not. You know, commenting on what is screwed up about the world and what, you know, the experience of living as a human being on Earth predates print media. So it became my responsibility to show, you know, the deep significance of using art to communicate, and the historical truism, it dates back to 33,000 BC, so it's been around for a little while.
Yeah, you know, I used to have a subscription to the newspaper that came around in 33,000 BC. I knew what was going on, but no, it's interesting because when you tied that back And we should tell, first, before we get into the particulars, tell people exactly what the exhibit consists of.
It consists of, the main part of the exhibit is it's 15 living cartoonists who I contacted and asked them to submit a handful of their own favorite pieces were that they had created, and also a handful of other pieces of art that you know, inform their passions and influence them. And I really wanted to just have a serious conversation about, you know, with the artistic mind and how it works, because it functions differently than other minds. I have found that it tends to be a little bit more honest. And I just use there's a Picasso quote that he says that art is a finger up the bourgeoisie ass, which is true. I mean, and initially it's just like, whoa. But then you think about it, you know, there's the medical side of that. It's really a screening.
Okay. Well, this is going to go over really big. Okay. Go on, my friend.
I won't get bluer than that. But, so it has 15 living cartoonists who are current. Most of them are currently publishing, but some of them are from the 50s and 60s. And then I padded it out with somewhere around 70 individual cartoons from history that I thought, you know, would just help the narrative. So there's a ton of stuff on the wall. I just ran out of space because, as you could probably guess, the vast amounts of material to draw from it's impossible to comprehend.
Mm-hmm. You know, it's interesting because as you look at this, you know, when you were and you've written this really actually very thoughtful and provocative essay on the exhibit and on the questions that you're posing about where to or will it continue in terms of editorial cartooning. And it's very heavy when you look at this. I think what was the quote? I'm looking for it now and I just can't find it, but there was a quote that about it's dangerous to be oppositional in a society with
things. Yeah, it was the Voltaire quote.
Yeah, the Voltaire quote. Yeah, here it is. It's dangerous to be right when the government is wrong. And you really got, you know, a sense of this wasn't just people who were the people you have on exhibit are not just people who are, you know, like sort of, oh, well, I think I'll do this or this will be a unique thing. But the people are really concerned or angry or, you know, just zeroed in. We've got to focus on this. And there was one, I can't remember his name, Auth, I think his name.
Uh-huh.
And he talked about Conrad and the influence of Conrad on him.
Right.
And in
right.
particular, him showing Conrad his work and Conrad saying, look, you've got to be like you've got to come off like you just read the newspaper and said, oh, hell no, I got to say something about that. And you're yelling about it, which I thought was really a really interesting way to look at this.
Yeah, it is. It's really a way, like I said, I think that's how artists approach problems. I mean, if you see an injustice or you see something, even if it's something you want to celebrate, the most exciting way to render that, you know, is to grab hold of the lightning bolt right as it emerges from the cloud, you know, because you can completely overwork something and destroy the enthusiasm of the idea if you wait too long.
Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, Dwayne, you have people like that. I don't think people necessarily would, you know, think of them in terms of editorial cartooning, even though when I'm looking at the exhibit, I was like, wow, this is right. You know, people like R. Crumb, you know,
right.
People. And then you look at and, you know, there's him and you're thinking, OK, yeah, he was actually making some pretty biting social commentary. But then you have other and I'm thinking about the. Too often, I think people are boxed into this idea that editorial cartooning is one panel, or maybe they've expanded to Tom Tomorrow, where it involves a lot more reading than visual. But there's also you included people like Joe Sacco, which it's kind of interesting that sort of contrast between styles and forms in that.
Yeah, I just wanted to show that there's, you know, the rich tradition. Really, when you look at it, that's why it's not called the political cartoon. You know, because I, you know, as it was initially supposed to be about political cartooning, but the more you look, you really start to understand that using images to comment on the culture is where it's at. You know, I mean, it is political to talk about poetry. It is political to talk about, you know, why people are excited or being persecuted for some reason. You know, the environment is a political issue, but when it all comes down to it, it's all about human beings and humanitarianism. And that is much more vast than trying to figure out, you know, whether the Republicans are wrong or the Democrats have the right idea.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dwayne Booth, a.k.a. Mr. Fish. You know, I really don't like that AKA. I ought to just call you Dwayne Mr. Fish Booth, okay? That's what it goes to. Anyway, we're talking about the exhibit he's curated down at USC at the Annenberg School of Communication called Drawing Conclusions, the Editorial Cartoon. Now, you know, there's other people in there. Two other people I wanted to talk about. There's many people. I kept writing down lists of names yesterday and saying, oh, God, this is amazing. But two that really struck me. One was the inclusion of Banksy, which brings this whole thing, actually, in a certain sense, brings this whole thing both into a bigger public sphere in terms of editorial cartooning and also has that intersection with fine art as well.
Right. Yeah, it's true. I mean, but again, in history, there was graffiti in Pompeii before the volcano went off. You know, that was commentary on personal things, political things. You know, just the great tradition of making your work available to the public. It doesn't necessarily have to be, you know, through a publication. And that's what I love about Banksy. Banksy, it reminds me of something that Bob Dylan actually said about art. He said that art does not belong in museums. He said the best place to hang a piece of art is above the toilet at a gas station. Because that's where people are going to see it, you know, and that's where it becomes less precious and less, you know, it's not commodified to the degree that, like, a museum suggests it should be. So then you get the content of what the artist is trying to say a lot clearer.
Yeah. You know, another person that really grabbed me, and maybe it's because it was had such a powerful impact on me at the time that he was doing all this, maybe at the time that I was actually going from somebody whose major form of rebellion was smoking and getting out of Catholic school, you know, was Conrad, you know? And
right.
I was really moved by what was there on the wall of his work. Just incredible stuff. You forget how important that was.
And the longevity of his stuff. I mean, he did it for decades, you know, and this stuff resonates. It's everything. That it was a really tough thing because he's the only cartoonist that I included inside these gigantic panels who's no longer living.
Mm-hmm.
And I dealt with his son, talked to his son about, you know, what should be included and stuff, and he knew that I got to meet and hang out a little bit with Paul Conrad before he passed away. So he said, you should be the one. You're a cartoonist, you pick, you know. So it was a blessing, but it was also a curse because, you know, there's hundreds to choose from. But it was a great joy to sort of be humbled by somebody else who was so prolific and so smart for so long.
Mm-hmm. You know, another thing that came up again, and I'm moving along on this because even though I really wanted to talk about some of these Conrad pieces, and actually maybe we'll have you back to just get into this in a bigger way. But you know, you included people like, you know, you weren't just going for people who were sort of defined as progressive or,
right,
you know, being against a wrong government. You actually have people and one of the ones I'll just name is Michael Ramirez, who I have to tell you, you know, I used to read his stuff and get so outraged, you know, because I was like, this is so damn backward, you know, and then I'm reading the comments he makes. He says, look, I'm not conservative or liberal. I'm not this or that. And he says, I don't really give a damn whether you like me or not. But it's, and it kind of, there's a kind of that crusty kind of, you know, sentiment seems to be part of what everyone's doing. I don't really care whether you like this. I need to tell some truth here.
Yeah, and it's true. I mean, and that's why I really wanted to have Ramirez hanging right next to Paul Conrad.
Mm-hmm. Because,
you know, Ramirez moved in after Paul Conrad left the LA Times. And there was a tremendous outpouring of fury at the fact that, you know, this conservative right-wing cartoonist had taken, you know, Conrad's place. And I was with Ramirez at a conference, and in the audience, somebody even during the Q&A asked me if I was furious that Ramirez is sitting next to me. are you furious that Ramirez, you know, is in the LA Times, blah, blah, blah. And I defended him. And what I said, and I'm like you, I would read his stuff and just rage. But at the same, I knew that people were doing the same thing with my things. You know, so what I had said to the audience and about Ramirez was that, you know what, if I do find Michael Ramirez's ideas reprehensible, I think it's much more important to have people with those kinds of ideas out in public so that you can engage those people rather than drive them underground.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, a movement that is driven underground just tends to feed on itself and become much more dangerous than when it's out in the light.
Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because it has meaning in, you know, now today, but it will have even greater meaning when people go for a society where you can actually be truly liberated. What would you do with people who have opinions opposed to what would actually, in fact, be a genuinely progressive liberatory government or society, and people who have opposing opinions, including opinions that say we should go back to where we were. You know, you're going to have to deal with things like that.
Right. That's democracy. I mean, it's messy. It's supposed to be uncomfortable.
Well, I'd say let's leave the democracy thing out. All right. Anyway, the whole thing here is, you know, one of the things I wanted to actually ask you, and we have about 2 minutes left, maybe less. I wanted to ask you real quick. You pose a question towards the end of your essay. Is it a vocation or a calling to be a editorial cartoonist? What is it, man?
It's a calling. It's a calling for the people who are good. You know, it's the same. You can ask the question about medical doctors. You know, I'm sure that you've had medical doctors where you know they're treating you by the book and there's no artistry there, but then there's some people that are blessed with whatever talent that is. You know, so I would say that, you know, it's a calling for the people who are really making a difference, and for the others, it's just a job, and you should ridicule them for that.
Well, Duane, I've had doctors who were actually editorial cartoonists as well, so there you go.
Small world.
Yeah, right. All right. Duane, Mr. Fishbooth. Duane, well, thanks for being at the show, man.
Sure, anytime.
Yeah, thanks. And we'll have you back soon. I really want to continue this conversation and dig into some other things with you. Always a pleasure, man.
Okay.
All right, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Duane Mr. Fish Booth about his new exhibit down at the Annenberg School of Journalism of Communication, Drawing Conclusions, the Editorial Cartoon. All right, well, that brings us to the close of another edition of The Michael Slate Show. I want to thank all of my guests today. Andy Worthington from CloseGuantanamo.org, Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party, the Stop Mass Incarceration, and the Stop, Stop, and Frisk Movement. And Duane Booth, a.k.a. the dapper and devilish Mr. Fish, talking about his new exhibit, Drawing Conclusions, the Editorial Cartoon. And most of all, I want to thank all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. And if you want to follow me on Twitter or friend me on Facebook, just go there and look for Michael Slate, the guy that looks like a radio host, all right? And remember, as we go out today and every week, yeah, the world is definitely a horror, but it doesn't have to be that way. And you have everything to do with changing that. So stay tuned and let's get into this and do this together. We're going to go out now with yet another piece from Jimmy Cliff. That's right, I'm addicted to Jimmy Cliff these days. And this piece is Rebel Rebel. Talk to you again next week.